and the people who love them.
Hello, my friends. This is Mickey Desai, your host and producer of The Thing About Cars. I've got a very exciting announcement for you. You may remember that special conversation we had with Warren Jobs. He's the CEO of Sealskin Covers. Well, guess what? We're going to actually give away a Sealskin cover to one lucky listener of The Thing About Cars. At the end of this episode, I'll tell you how to enter to win the Sealskin cover. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy this episode of The Thing About Cars. Hello again. Welcome, my friends. This is Mickey Desai, one of your hosts for The Thing About Cars, sitting here in Strongbox West in the somewhat damp city of Atlanta today. Around the table, we've got
Ben,
Ronnie,
Becca,
and a full agenda again for us today. I wrote down something that a friend of mine had said via my Facebook page, but I'm trying to stick to a certain structure for the show, and so we're going to start with the Grand Trivia Auto trivia question of the day. I'm sure Ronnie's going to know this one, and he may even blurt it right out, in which case we'll go to the second trivia section. But the trivia question for the day is, tires are labeled with a long combination of letters and numbers, like P215/65R15 89H. What does that last letter in this example, H, refer to? Does it refer to optimal operating temperature? Does it refer to the highest safe speed? Does it refer to maximum vehicle weight? Or to fully inflated tire weight? Should we just answer it now and go on to a better question for the rest of the show, or you just want to, what do you want to do?
I mean,
I think everyone around the table knows the answer.
Everyone
at
the table, I'm sure, knows the answer, but
go ahead, go for it, Ronnie.
It's your speed rating.
That's right. It's the highest safe speed rating.
Yeah.
The letter rating, i.e. WZZR, others refers to the maximum safe speed tires are capable of. But so what are the ratings, and what should the average consumer look for their
always go
drivers?
For Z. Always go for Z.
Well, H is considered standard, middle of the road, average person. You're not a race car driver. You're not driving a big old pickup or off-road. Or Z is something that he and I would probably use. That's for your sports cars, muscle cars, if you're going to be.
I probably wouldn't put a Z tire on a pickup truck.
What
not
about
with that attitude?
What are they, the ZR1 pickups or a Rumblebee, which, by the way, I just love that it's called a Rumblebee.
Love
that.
But so is it generally speaking that the higher number, the letter, the higher speed it can handle?
Not necessarily, because Y is actually the highest speed rating you can get.
Oh.
Y is for exotic sports cars. It is rated to 300 kilometers an hour. If you have a Y in parentheses, it makes it look like boobies, but it's also rated for 300 kilometers plus. W is up to 270. Z is actually 240 plus, which is most of your production cars, production sports cars, 240 kilometers an hour. So BMWs and the such are limited at 155, so you wouldn't need more than a Z-rated tire anymore.
My knowledge is a little dated, but isn't the Bugatti Veyron the only thing that actually goes over 300 kilometers per hour?
I think the Chiron does as well now. There's several Bugattis. I think there's a Pagani that goes 300 plus. I think there's a Lycan, which is a car made out of Dubai, that goes 300 plus. Veyron was the first production car that did it, but then a lot of people tried to follow suit and succeeded.
Of all the ones he just mentioned, you could round up every one of them in the world and you wouldn't fill up a mall parking lot. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Right.
Would they be just as sticky if you get up towards W, and would they be just as sticky?
So that usually has to do with compound rating.
Right.
So I usually look at tread wear to tell me whether.
Yeah, I usually look at the warranty, basically, to decide, okay, these are warrantied up to 20,000 miles. Those are nice and sticky. But
we should do The Thing About Cars guide to tires. I mean, I think that there's some basic stuff out there that I don't know, and that the average user doesn't know, in terms of how do you look at tread wear? What does that mean? What does all weather mean versus something else? If I live in Georgia, do I need snow tires?
Things or the like penny that. Test.
The penny test.
People need to know about penny tests. Maybe where if you get a nail in your tire, where is it that it can be patched? Or
right.
Yeah, I'm sure we could do a whole episode at least
on
tires.
All right, let's make that happen. Let's get that together for our next recording session. A friend of mine wrote on my Facebook page. He says, and I can't remember who wrote this, so forgive me for forgetting, but he says, tachometers are stupid and a waste of space on the dashboard of an automatic transmission equipped vehicle.
I'm grunting over here if it picked it up. I backed it up, but not quite soon enough. Grrr.
So I mean, I know where this person's coming from, but I kind of disagree. I kind of like having attack even on an automatic. What do you guys think?
Ew.
Because like, me.
Mr. Cutter.
Exactly. one thing that it's always been big with me that I have to have a car with attack just because it can be one of your first signs that there's a problem.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
So when you're just kind of doing old school and you're not hooking up whatever computers or something to go to it, your tachometer, even being a little bit off, it can be your first warning sign something isn't quite right with your car.
Especially with as quiet and vibrationless as a lot of modern cars are. Sometimes that's the only thing that'll tell you it's not running.
Well, my Mustangs have never really been quiet or vibrationless. By
running.
That would be my Pontiac.
Oh, you're right.
I have never had a Mustang fail me ever.
Right.
And mine is 20 years old.
Unicorn of a Mustang. God.
No,
yeah. No. It's a lot of unicorns.
Right.
I'm the unicorn whisperer. I don't know.
You need a tachometer. Well, you don't need one, but from a diagnostic point of view, tachometers tell you whether your transmission is slipping. It'll tell you whether your transmission is failing if you don't have your next gear. If you want to do engine braking, assuming you don't have a CVT transmission and you just want to drop your gears to help you slow down in emergency situations, or if you just want to preserve your brakes a little bit, you'll know that you're not over revving your engine. There's a couple of valuable tidbits of information that a tachometer can give you. And, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that's like, oh, it has to be analog or it has to be digital. Like, I really don't care about that. But
you just want the data.
I need data. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Data is very, very critical.
Exactly. Exactly.
The argument that I have here is that everyone here at this table is both a driver and a gearhead, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We like the data. I mourn the loss of a voltmeter on my dashboard. I want to see the oil temperature. I want to see the coolant temperature.
Install some. Install some.
I could install some, but these things used to be like the car that I learned how to drive on, a good old Chevy Malibu Classic, had that information. The Chevy Malibu Classic was nothing. It was just a family sedan, and it still
standard.
Had that stuff in there.
Yeah.
Now your everyday family sedan barely has anything.
I don't think most people know what to do with them.
Right. So the average driver doesn't need a tech either, even though all of us find it useful.
Right. Well, I think this is a conversation that we herald back to from a while ago where manufacturers have started making cars so dummy proof that it's just making our average drivers dumber. Like, it's very painful.
The thing with the gauges, the Volkswagens I had, and these were Mark IV Golf variants, they had a temperature gauge. But you know what? Unless the engine was blowing up, that thing just sat in the middle. And they were so well damped because if it actually swung much and reflected anything accurately going on, the average consumer would freak out and think something's up with their car.
Right.
Well, see,
and modern cars are so reliable and idiot proof that we don't need it.
I've had a car where the faster you go, you can watch the temperature gauge down because of the airflow from the speed. Yeah. So, but it was set up for the airflow to help a lot.
1993 240SX, which I had the worst time bleeding the cooling system out of, gave the slightest readings, you know, the fluctuation on the needle. It didn't give me the specific degree, but I can tell that the cooling system is working, and you know, I can see that the thermostat opened, and I could see when the fan clutch engaged, and you know, it was just microscopic movements to let me know that it was actually reading a value rather than the gauge cluster was giving me erroneous readings from a bad ground or something along those lines.
Right.
And your thermostat can get stuck, and that's
a
really cheap little part that can cause lots of damage. So definitely good information to have. The oil pressure is one that gets me. I would rather have oil temperature over oil pressure because pretty much if that one goes down, you're in some pretty big trouble. But I would like oil temperature.
I mean, there is the oil warning light. Like if your pressure drops out the bottom, the light does go on.
Yes, but all your oil has just fallen out of the car, and you should know by the large banging noise.
The thing about oil temperature, though, unless you have a turbo, you're not going to overheat your oil If you overheat your oil on a naturally aspirated vehicle, something else is tremendously wrong.
Well, mine, again, is just about the data and knowing about the environment of the car, how it's operating. Not necessarily that it's going to make some huge impact on something.
Right.
We're laughing because I'm going to have to edit this out, but my phone just, in trying to position my phone so that everyone could read the countdown clock, it buzzed because someone sent me a text message. So again, you know, we like the data. I would like to see standard gauges return.
But we really don't need them.
But the rest of the world doesn't need them.
No, most of us don't.
Yeah.
And most of us who like having the data don't need it. I didn't say everybody, but most of us.
I've had a couple friends who said, well, the oil light only came on a few times. And I'm like,
Right.
So maybe some advance warning on that would have been useful.
Well, here's one for the manufacturers, something a little bit more specific, because right now the whole check engine or whatever little icon you have pop up is pretty much like the blue screen of death. Mm-hmm. Something is wrong with your car.
Right.
Thanks. Could you, now some cars, my Pontiac, when it's running, you can actually press a button in a certain way and it'll give you its own code that it's throwing out. So I mean, even something like that, can the general person even make use of it, or do they all just drive straight to a garage anymore,
pretty much,
and say it went and made a funny noise? I
think a lot of problems stem from the lack of education in all of these situations. Critical thinking isn't exactly a forte of the common folk in America, anywhere in the world, honestly. If you travel about, you know, critical thinking is one of those things that seems to be a dying art, or maybe an art that's being resuscitated thanks to the millennial generation that's like that came up with an Area 51 raid in such a way that they said, "Screw life, this sucks. We're gonna raid Area 51 and find aliens." So maybe critical thinking is coming back around.
Are you going to the raid, Ronnie?
I am listed as going to the raid, and I'm sure the FBI will be at my door any minute. It's gonna be great. Not in it to clap alien cheeks, just there to have some good times. Just want to have some beer and listen to music.
Hey, if there's a carpool, I will happily go I will happily go along for the ride.
There might be some hot bits in those saucers that'll make your car faster.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, alien technology.
The map they have, this is a bit of a tangent, but they have a little drawn out map of Area 51 by the creators, and there's like a UFO salvage yard, and then there's like a UFO hangar, and then there's it's like an alien bunker or something. I would go straight to the salvage yard and be like, all right, what can I put on my 240?
Exactly. Right.
I know there's like a 2 mile long runway there, and you know that, what a great drag strip that would be.
Can you imagine the kind of tires we could destroy on that?
Government hanging out, holding out on us, man. It's terrible.
Right, right. Totally. Better than that eighth of a mile track we used to have way out in the boondocks.
Mm-hmm.
Eighth of a mile. You can't even run something like a Mustang on that. You need the whole thing to stop.
My car would probably only reach 30 miles an hour in that much space.
Well, see, I could either get up really fast or stop safely.
Right.
There was no go really fast and stop safely. Right. Yeah.
So, are we saying tachometers are stupid and a waste of time?
No,
not at all.
All right.
More data, the better. Quick correction from what we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. The Bugatti Veyron broke 400 kilometers an hour, not 300.
Wow.
And it's also erroneous to say that it was the first one, because the first production vehicle that broke 400 kilometers an hour is the Callaway Sledgehammer back in 1988.
Whoa.
It's a modified and tuner version of a Chevrolet Corvette production car tested by Deutschmann Design at a transportation research center. And if you want to call the modified version, you know, as not counting, in 1993, the Dauer 962 Le Mans broke 404.6 kilometers an hour, which isn't as fast as the Veyron, but still broke 400 kilometers an hour in 1993. Also in 1993, that's 351 kilometers an hour. So, there were a couple of cars that broke the 400 kilometer an hour limit, which is 250-ish miles per hour.
Crazy fast.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
That's nuts. All right. So This is actually a pretty good segue. You mentioned Corvette, and the big news of the day, of the last couple days, in a matter of fact, is the big news from Corvette, which is
the 2020 C8 mid-engine.
Yeah.
See, I figure Ben was chomping at the bit. I wasn't even going to say anything. He's been so excited about this.
Well, I don't know about excited. I've been kind of keeping up with the developments as it's been.
Giddy sort of, like a schoolgirl.
As it's been forthcoming, yeah. forthcoming, right.
Right.
So every author's favorite word. Anyway, yeah, I mean, they've been pushing this thing for a while, kind of hyping it, kind of getting us all curious. I mean, the GM CEO herself even teased it a little bit a couple months ago. And finally, a few nights ago, two nights ago, something like that, they had this thing you could watch live online, and it was a little cheesy because they had two former astronauts who talked about space for 15 minutes before, you know, anything to do with cars. And even then, the, you know, space tie-in with the thing I thought was a little corny, a little bit opportunistic since this is the anniversary week of Apollo 11.
Right.
But they finally showed us the car, and it's pretty cool. I would have done a couple things a little differently on it, but that's just my personal taste. It looks like it's pretty fabulous, and one of the big news items with it is that it's going to start below $60,000, in theory at least. I take that with a grain of salt.
$59,999.
Right. And even then, to get one that's that basic and depackaged, you'd probably have to special order it.
Yeah.
I imagine the average ones going to dealers are probably going to be 80 plus because they'll have certain trim packages and things like that.
No AC, no radio.
Yeah.
Well, they would include that into a track option, kind of like the Porsche 911 GT3. They would have a Corvette equivalent, and then they would charge even more for it.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I was thinking the Cobra R that came out back the beginning of the what people call the new edge, and no AC or anything, but the asterisk was not for street driving.
But hasn't Corvette come under a little bit of criticism for doing a mid-engine car? It's like, I think the criticism is along the lines of they're just trying to be like everyone else now, building a supercar.
Well, I don't think so, because this is something they've toyed with since at least the 1960s. There have been several mid-engine Corvette prototypes over the years, and some of them came closer than others to consideration for production. But I think the point they're at now is that they feel that the front-engine sports car has been developed as far as at least Chevrolet can develop it. I think they felt this was just sort of the next logical step. And I'm pretty sure that the front engine one is going away with this. There was some talk for a while. Nobody knew, was it going to be alongside or instead of or what. But I think this is going to be the new one.
Yeah.
There's also talk that Corvette's going to become a separate brand. I don't know if that's really happening or not.
I've heard that about Corvette and Mustang.
Yeah, sure.
Well, see, you know what, though? Maybe we should design our own sports car then. If Chevy's throwing up their hands and saying these have been designed as far as they can go, we need to design a sports car.
It's interesting because Ferrari a few years ago went back to a few front engine models after many years of not doing that.
I think that's Ferrari's transition into developing something that's more practical for consumers.
Could be.
Because
could be.
I was speaking with Porsche Engineering a number of months ago about, you know, how the direction of Porsche in general with motorsports. And they said, you know, when the Cayenne came out, when the Boxster first came out, everyone threw up their hands and said, this isn't a real Porsche. This is ridiculous. Why would Porsche ever produce something like this? It's cheap.
Looks
it's
like
tiny,
a frog squatting.
It looks ugly.
Right.
But it was an amazing selling vehicle with a great profit margin that helped keep the company alive. And then they did the same thing with the Cayenne. The Cayenne SUV came out. And all the Porsche fanatics said, oh, my God, what's this SUV doing in our lineup? We're a sports car manufacturer.
I still say that. Yeah.
But the numbers kept Porsche alive. Like, if it wasn't for the Cayenne, the Macan, the Boxster, and the Cayman, Porsche may be bankrupt right now. And I think the same thing is kind of happening with a lot of manufacturers domestically. Ford is getting rid of all of their lineup except for the Mustang and the Mustang, their pickup trucks, and the Focus, I think.
I think it was pretty much they're going to keep trucks and SUVs and the Mustang. I'm not sure if they're keeping any other
I know they're whittling down their roster tremendously. I think GM is starting to take realization that they should start doing the same thing?
Chrysler too.
That's something that my friend told me, and I had not gone back out to research this. And you guys have laptops up. Maybe you can find something now. There had been some talks, according to my friend. Okay, I had some expletives to say. Apparently, there had been some talks between Ford and GM about some sort of, I hesitate to use the word merger. I'll err over on collaboration because I don't like that idea. But he had mentioned that he had read a news story about a possible combining of Ford and GM.
That would be my hell freezes over moment.
That's what a lot of people said about the Corvette too.
I mean, what that
I doubt that they would do it.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't rule it beyond possibility.
But a merger between Ford and GM, I mean, that's like, you know, two major competitors. That's like Apollo Creed and Rocky Balboa getting together to beat, you know, some sort of childhood disease or something.
I don't know. You know what? I'm going to hop over. I know he tried to send me a link at one time, and I was twitching enough at the thought, so I didn't click on the link. So I'm just going to see if I can find it.
All right. So what we'll do is we'll wrap this episode, and we'll do our research, and we'll come back for the next episode, and we'll start with that.
All right.
Okay.
Great. So this has been The Thing About Cars. Thank you, as always, for joining us, recording in Strongbox West in Atlanta. Please check out our Patreon and become our supporters. We're actually looking for a little more support via the Patreon channel, and there's a couple of interesting perks to be had if you donate to us via Patreon. And if you can think of ideas for better perks, please drop us a line and let us know. You can find us at thethingaboutcars.com. That's our webpage, or on Facebook at The Thing About Cars. In the meantime, thanks again for joining us, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
All right, so this is how you win the Sealskin cover, courtesy of the Sealskin Covers Company. Go to the Thing About Cars website. That's thethingaboutcars.com. There you should find a link to a blog post entitled, "We're Giving Away a Sealskin Cover." There you'll find a link to a form which you can use to enter. It doesn't matter what you drive or where you live. All you have to do is give us a name and a valid email address via that form. And while you're at it, we always appreciate your feedback about the show. One lucky listener will be selected at random to win their very own Sealskin cover, courtesy of Warren Jobs and the Sealskin Covers Company. Thanks, as always, for being a part of the Thing About Cars family. We'll see you soon.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.